Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we're going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from the leaders and decision makers who are shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, South Africa's citrus industry meets with government over US trade tariff threats. New research on how younger South Africans are managing their relationship with credit. Will taxis ever go cashless? And an expert view on the challenges of scaling a business. It's Wednesday, the 26th of March. South Africa's citrus industry, it really is one of the crown jewels of our agricultural exports, is facing a major threat, as you would have heard. The United States is considering imposing steep tariffs on South African citrus over the ongoing bitter trade dispute. And it, if it goes through, tens of thousands of local farm jobs could be on the line, I understand. For an industry that contributes billions to the economy and supports many rural households, this is no small issue. So what's behind this looming trade war? What does it really mean for South African workers, exporters and rural economies? I'm in conversation now with Gerrit van der Merwe, who is chair of the Citrus Growers Association. Mr. van der Merwe, a warm welcome to you. Let's dive straight in and look at the economic impact if these tariffs go ahead. What do the numbers look like and who is likely then to be hit hardest?
Well, at the moment, for the South African industry being the second biggest exporter in the world, 9% of our product goes to North America at the moment. It doesn't sound like a lot, but for areas like the Western Cape, small towns like Citrus Dull, it is their livelihood. And for our estimations, we probably calculate about 35,000 jobs will be affected in South Africa, but also about 25,000 jobs will be indirectly affected in the USA side, because it's been an industry that's been doing for about 20 years. So thus, you've got supply chains, you've got truckers, you've got everyone on that side involved as well. So yes, people will call it margins, people will call it 1 or 2% of the GDP, but it's 100% of the economy of a small town like Citrus Dull. So yes, the impact will be big, although it will be isolated.
You have been meeting with government. What is the industry asking for, if anything, and what have you been told or what have you been given?
We've basically started asking, what is the strategy? Are we going to BRICS? Are we moving away from the USA? Are we going to start building relationships back into the USA and see if we can at least defend AGOA or come up with a new trade agreement after AGOA expires at the end of the year and it doesn't get renewed? So our question is, what is the strategy? And if so, we have to go more to the east, to China and India. We probably have to ask, but then we need to get away with import tariffs, because India is charging us around 40%. China is also on the high side. So we have a lot of import tariffs we're running into the east, although it's BRICS. The only free trade agreements we have is Europe, Canada, and the USA. So thus, it puts us on a back foot competing with countries like a Chile and a Peru and Australia. All has very good free trade agreements going into the Far East.
And are you satisfied so far with the response that you've received?
I'm a farmer. We're never satisfied. But no, I think we in Citrus Dull, I'm a farmer in Citrus Dull, we are panicking. I mean, this is our livelihood. It's been the lifeline of a small town like Citrus Dull of 15,000 people, Glen William, Tin, and all other small towns. And this is our bit. Although only 25% of our fruit goes to the USA, it's the best 25. And that's where our margins come from. And that's where we actually prepare our crops for the USA, which is a lot more expensive. So it's a knock-on effect. And you can't just replace a market. We've been developing in that market for about 20 years. We ourselves as ALG has got an import company based in Florida. We've got relationships going back 18 years with a company like Whole Foods. So you can't just say, let's pack up and go to China and it's going to be all the same. It's going to take time. There's going to be blood on the streets. And unfortunately, it's not just the farmer that's going to suffer, it's the farming community. And that's the biggest thing that worries me.
In the past, do you think that South Africa has done enough risk planning in this respect and done enough to diversify its export market outside of the United States of America?
No, I think let's start. We do have good market access to a lot of countries because citrus being such a big commodity, we do have access to a lot of markets, but we don't have any bilaterals or free trade agreement. So it puts you in a back foot. You can start negotiate going into a market, but if you're running into a 40% or 20% or 18% import tariff and your competition has got zero, you can't develop that market properly and you're always on the back foot. So no, more should be done, Jeremy. I'm not sure if we can criticize if it's not done. It's not enough has been done, but I do think we can't just switch. It will take 5 to 10 years for us to switch properly to make sure we get proper market access, but also favorable trade agreements.
And the reality of the situation is you don't have 5 or 10 years, if I'm hearing you correctly.
No, I mean, you've put yourselves in a minimum wage. He doesn't have 2 weeks to go without money. And I mean, the government's boasting that they're putting 25 million on people on the government grants. I do think that's actually a bad thing. Because you want more people working and less people on grants, and that's where your economy grows. And if we don't have the U.S. market, a small town like Citrus Dollar is going to stop growing. And I think that's one of our biggest things. Economic growth in a small town like Citrus Dollar has been good. So crime has been low. Everybody's got a work to do. Everyone's pulling in the right direction. You stop that growth, you stop job creation, and then it gets into political turmoil. And then in 5 or 10 years, you're sitting with a government that's not working, or local government's not working. So it's a real knock-on effect, not just now, but we got to grow. We've got 40% unemployment in South Africa. So we need wins. And USA is a market that provides wins. It gives us opportunity to grow. And we feel with the tactic now, it's completely going against what we've been doing the last 20 years and our plans the next 10 years.
Would the industry consider directly lobbying interest groups within the United States itself? Has that been put on the table?
Yeah, I do think we do have a lobbyist in Washington we use, but a lot of these big negotiation, it's state to state, and that you can only do so much from a lobbyist influence, ask what you can do. But at the end of the day, it's the politics is run by Trump and Ramaphosa, and it's got to be fixed there. Then we can't go from the bottom up to get there.
Just finally, would you agree that this is also the beginning of more agricultural trade tension to come beyond the citrus industry? I would imagine that it's a broader sectoral issue and that there needs to be preparation for an increasingly protectionist world such as we're seeing.
I actually don't buy into that, Jeremy. You can argue the fact that tariffs stops outsourcing or factories, and that's probably what President Trump is trying to stop. But you can't outsource out-of-season citrus like the northern and the southern hemisphere. They don't have citrus come their summertime, which is our wintertime, so they can't do insourcing. So what we've been doing is we've been keeping the cost low in the USA. We've been roughly selling at the same price in the USA the last 20 years. Everybody's speaking about inflation, and we're actually helping with inflation. So I would actually think, yes, they can't outsource us or insource us for that matter, and we're actually helping with inflation. So importing out-of-season fruit is a net positive, and I can't really see the downside of it. I can understand people trying to stop building a factory in Mexico, and that factory needs to be in Texas, but I can't see you trying to insource out-of-season citrus because it's just not possible.
I'm going to leave it there. Gerrit van der Merwe, thank you very much indeed. Chair of the Citrus Growers Association, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Credit plays a crucial role in our financial lives. I don't need to tell you that, but how we use it and how much we rely on it, I guess, does change over time. So from young professionals taking on vehicle financing to retirees still managing credit card debt, generational shift in credit behavior tells us a lot about South Africa's economic landscape. So let me try and pull all of that together. And I'm in conversation tonight with Andrew Fulton, director at 8020. He's been on the program before. And Andrew, I always do appreciate your insights. So your research highlights significant differences in how different age groups use credit. Have you been able to discern the most striking generational trends?
we did. I mean, what was interesting with this is it came out of a piece of work that Stats South Africa did on the aging population of South Africa. The median age has gone from 33 in 1996 to 45 in 2022. And interestingly, you know, 30% of the white population is now 60 or older. So really interesting stats. And it made us think about, well, how do different life stages affect that credit journey? So moving out, starting tertiary education, landing a first job, getting married, and then empty nest in retirement. So what we noticed was, what is interesting is, you know, the population under the age of 35, which makes up 60% of the population, they only have 17% of all credit by value. So the interesting insight there was just how old the majority of people who have credit are. That was probably the most glaring difference and an interesting insight.
And that 60% under 35 is interesting. Is that because there is a reluctance or a fear of credit, or is it simply more difficult for them to access it?
I think it's stage of life, because if you think about it, we're actually talking value of credit, not number of credit products. That's a slightly different story. And value of credit, I mean, 50% of the value of credit is sitting in mortgages. And you're really not getting into a mortgage until you're into your late 30s, early 40s in this country. So that was the big one, is that big chunk of value, which is mortgages, is sitting in an older group. But if you look at, say, retail accounts, by volume, they're almost half of loans or retail accounts, and 80% of credit active people under the age of 25 have a retail account. So that is a fairly common loan product at that age.
That's interesting, Andrew. So if that's the case then, so younger consumers then are starting with retail or maybe smaller credit before moving on to those bigger loans. But over time, does this impact their ability to build a strong credit history, which is crucial?
Absolutely. And I guess what we're trying to figure out, it's a little bit of a harder thing to look at, is, you know, are these people destroying their credit records early on through not being able to delay gratification, and then perhaps not being able to get mortgage finance and vehicle asset finance later in life because they sort of shot themselves in the foot at a young age to get a new pair of jeans and a pair of sneakers. So that's one thing we're certainly looking at and trying to ascertain. But yes, as you get older, there's a strong correlation between age and credit score. Obviously, fairly strong correlation between age and earnings. So you know, all these commitments get larger as you get older.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about getting older. Your data also shows that home loan ownership peaks in the 50s. I guess that makes sense. But this is the worrying bit. Credit cards and unsecured debt remain common into retirement. Is this a sign of resilience, or the fact that just more and more of us within that demographic are struggling a whole lot more?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a number of things. I mean, there's obviously never one cause for any outcome. But certainly, if you look at some of the hypotheses that we're considering, I mean, credit card debt is massive amongst older people, you know, plus 65 years of age. It could be that, I mean, as we noticed, 30% of people, of white people, are over 60. So that is still a demographic that holds on to a lot of wealth. So they could just be using credit cards to kind of look at cash flow, or it's easier to buy, or maybe because they're getting points on their credit cards. There's a number of reasons for that. But also, as you mentioned, the unsecured goes up into older age as well. So, you know, that could be just rising living costs, inadequate retirement savings have led people to increase their credit in order to make those ends meet. And the one thing we can't argue is there are not a lot of South Africans out there that are prepared for retirement. So perhaps relying on credit to kind of cover some shortfall.
Yeah, I mean, and that's perfectly understandable, isn't it? Let's talk about overdue balances. This is a fairly alarming figure. Have grown by $11.5 billion in the last year. So that's growing by $11.5 billion. To what do you attribute that, and which generation is struggling the most with debt repayment?
Yeah, so overdue balances have gotten up to $200 billion, which is a large number. It is still, I mean, only in parentheses, 8% of total debt, but it is growing, as you said, $11.5 billion in the past year. Where it's growing is also quite worrying. I mean, the big growth numbers, 23%. In home loans. So home loan overdue debt's gone up by 23% in a year. And that's all sitting with sort of our heavy header segment. So at 80-20, we've created an 8-segment view of South Africa. And the heavy hitters are the 3 million wealthiest South Africans. They're the ones that are sitting with these massive growths and overdue balances, both in credit cards and in home loans. So yeah, that's not a great direction to be going in.
Let me pick you up on home loans. Home loan balances growing 50 times faster than the number of home loan holders. What do you think this says about affordability?
it's getting harder and harder. We've noticed that over the past, you know, 5-6 years, we've been looking at this space. Debt is getting concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. I mean, if you saw sort of the 3.2% year-on-year increase in total debt, but not a very big increase in total number of debt holders. So what we are seeing is that fewer people are taking out more and larger debts. And that's the case where you end up getting a situation where, you know, home loan balance is growing 50 times faster than the number of people taking on those debts.
All right, final question, and let me tap you for a bit of free financial advice here. If someone wants to then build, as against a backdrop of all the data that you've given us, a solid credit profile across their lifetime, is there an optimum strategy to follow to avoid financial pitfall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm always find it funny. 25 years ago, when I first wanted to buy my first car, FNB told me to cross the street and take out a retail loan with Edgar's, because they wanted Edgar's to do that whole credit vetting and have some experience with credit. Because I don't know if it's because they're lazy or the cost or whatever. It was quite hilarious to me, but I realized that's still the case. So I mean, I guess, you know, my advice would be go out and get some retail credit early, you know, as early as you can, but use it wisely, you know, like buy a few things. I mean, there's a lot of benefits that come with it. Sometimes you get great vouchers, some deals, you know, use it wisely, and then just keep your credit nose clean, pay off your debts, and then apply for more credit as and when needed. And if you do get into trouble, definitely go into debt counseling, because it's available, it can help you out, and it can lower your monthly payments. But yeah, I mean, because that's the thing, is you don't want to be locked out of really beneficial credit like a mortgage when you get later on in life, or even a credit card. I mean, credit card's a great way to kind of manage your finances, manage your cash flow, and you know, make points with loyalty programs. So yeah, that'd be my advice.
So 25 years ago, you bought a new car and drove off in a nice pair of chinos.
Yeah, I did. I bought a secondhand car and a nice pair of chinos, yeah.
All right, Andrew Fulton, I'm sure we'll talk again in the year. Thank you so much indeed, Director at AT20.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
For millions of South Africans, minibus taxis are the backbone of daily transport, but handling cash on the go has long been a challenge, one that obviously raises concerns about safety, efficiency, I guess accountability. Now with the push for fully cashless taxi systems by next year, the cash or payment solutions company Waxed has introduced a digital fare collection system that I am told is already making waves. But here's my question, is the industry ready to ditch cash for good, and can it overcome resistance to digital payments? Anthony Stewart is the Chief Executive Officer of the organization, and let's find out what's working, what's not, and whether cashless taxis are truly the future of transport. So Anthony, a very warm welcome. So I would say to you that the idea of cashless taxis isn't new, but previous attempts have struggled. Why do you think that is, and the intervention that you're implementing, why is it different?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think in the last 10 years, I know of 12 to 14 implementations that have gone awry, and they've gone awry for various reasons. Right from, I think the biggest one is not considering the larger ecosystem. You know, a taxi doesn't operate, you can't just stick a credit card machine into a taxi and then think that it's now cashless. You've got to consider the fact that if the taxi driver no longer has cash, how is he or she going to put fuel into the taxi? Okay. And the commuters that come there as well might also have cash, but they don't have a bank account, but now the taxi's cashless. So you have to consider all of these things. And that's kind of what we've done. We've gone and said, if you approach with a cash, you can go to a spaza shop that's right next to the taxi rank, many different little spaza shops, and go and buy a paper ticket from them or top up one of the national travel cards. And if you've got a bank card, you can just jump directly onto the taxi. But what we've done, I think that's also been a big change, is that during the day, the user can pull down on the funds from the taxi to actually fill up the taxi. And at night, the driver, the owner, the marshals, the associations, all the different role players involved all get settled their cash at night immediately. And that's, you know, that's a massive benefit of cash, is that it's readily available. And the second you go to cashless, you normally go and say, well, I have to wait 3-4 days for my credit card money to come in, or up to 7 days for the SANRAL funds to come in. What we're doing is we are settling that with all the role players at night and immediately.
Let me suggest to you, though, that a cash system perhaps works better in an industry, because it's simply a question of being able to bypass paying tax.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a misnomer that the taxis don't pay tax. They do pay tax, but it's a smaller amount. In order to get a taxi license, to operate as a taxi operator, you have to go to SARS and get a tax clearance certificate. And there's a formula that the guys work on to go and say, you know, I do so many trips per day, I take so many commuters, et cetera, et cetera. And then the government works out a small amount of tax that's due. Now, what's nice with this is that the owners can get better control over their business. They're not sure of the money that's coming in because you don't know how much is being held onto by the drivers or if the commuters are paying the full amount, as an example. But more importantly, they can also see now when they're spending money that they're spending money on repairs, they're spending money on fuel, they're spending money on the driver, et cetera, et cetera. And you can run your taxi now as more as an efficient business. And if you have a business, you can then more effectively manage your tax obligations. But at the end of the day, it's going to still be up to the taxi owner as to how they pay their tax. Like with any business, it's what you declare to the receiver is what you're going to be paying, basically. So it's not necessarily the answer to tax, but it's definitely a step in the right direction.
I think I'm correct in saying that drivers and associations have historically resisted any kind of digital fare system. What's the biggest hurdle, or perhaps not what's the biggest hurdle, but how do you convince them to get over that hurdle that you've outlined to me already?
So it's all about giving more benefit than what you're losing. So if you are used to cash, as an example, you live in a cash-only environment, which means that you are not financially included. You can't apply for a vehicle finance or a home loan or even personal finance. Where now, if you've been paid through the cashless system, you can actually qualify for a home loan. Like, for instance, I've mentioned before that only 4% of taxi drivers actually own a home. And the reason is that it's so small is because they can't qualify for a home loan, where now you can qualify for a home loan. So being financially included is one of the benefits. Being able to sell airtime, lotto, electricity, additional forms of income, and even doing, for instance, that some of the taxis don't do anything from 9 to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, through the system, you could go and say, well, I actually want to go and do deliveries. And, for instance, go and help Takealot, for instance, to go and deliver their parcels at a fraction of the cost to Takealot, because the taxi is already paid for through the commuters in the morning and the evening. So what this does is it changes the taxi into this business unit that can generate a lot more cash. You know, the drivers have approached us and said, listen, can I take this device and when I'm finished working, can I go afterwards into my community and go and sell airtime or insurance or whatever the other products are that are available through our framework and go and make extra money? And that's the whole thing. It's not just limiting to only the traditional commuter payments.
Anthony, let me continue playing devil's advocate here. Let me try and poke another hole in the argument. And let me suggest to you that crime is a major concern in the industry. We know that. So a cashless payment could reduce robbery risk, but surely there's the potential of new vulnerability like digital fraud.
I think there is definitely some kind of vulnerabilities, but I think a lot of that is managed through the technology that we are using. You are right that robberies are massive. You know, when you do a survey with commuters, they come back and they say 100% of the commuters want to go cashless because they've had issues with either being robbed or having to get change. And so the reduction in crime is an important thing. I think, you know, it's like credit card fraud. You will get a level of credit card fraud, but you know, with the payments being quite small and how we're managing it, it's not the fraud is not on such a massive level as which you'd get in a retail store where you're buying clothing for like 1,000 rand or something like that. This is for a 10 or 12 rand trip that you're actually paying for using your debit or credit card.
And explain to me how the system would handle transactions in areas with poor network coverage, or what would happen if a commuter doesn't have mobile data.
So the beauty of that is we have a principle called deferred transactions, where the commuter can tap with their debit or credit card and it authorizes the transaction, very much like we do a tap transaction now. If you tap and you can just walk away, that's a deferred transaction. And that means that while you're away at a later point in the day, when the taxi gets signal, it will process that transaction. if it does have signal, then it can dial up and authorize you at that particular point in time. But so we do have the ability to do deferred transactions. And what we can also do is flag a credit card. For instance, if you tap the first time and you didn't have money, and you come back and you try and tap again at a later stage and there is signal, we can identify that card and say, listen, you know, there's still an outstanding amount of where you tapped before for 10 Rand, and we're going to process not just the 10 Rand transaction, but an additional 10 Rand for outstanding fees or something like that.
And just quickly in conclusion, what's the cost to a taxi owner or association for implementation?
So it's basically just the cost of the device, which is about 2,500 Rand. But the savings that they get are far beyond that, just in vehicle finance repayments, where, you know, the guys are paying up to 15,000 Rand a month to repay a taxi. Using a cashless system, the finance houses will look at going and doing, instead of Prime Plus, I think 15, they could go to Prime Plus 2 or 3, which is a 3,000-4,000 Rand a month saving for a taxi owner. So I think the benefits always have to outweigh the cost. So it's literally just the cost of the device that's the cost. And then there is your traditional banking transactional fees that we have to obviously cover to process across their rails.
Well, let's see how this plays out in the future. Anthony Stewart, fascinating stuff. Chief Executive Officer of the payment solutions company Waxed. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, scaling a business just isn't about growth. It's about growing the right way. And that tricky zone between 10 and 200 employees, I read, is where many businesses either break through and succeed or break down. There's a very interesting new book out on this. Jason Goldberg's new book called The Art of Scale is a practical, deeply researched guide to mastering that phrase, particularly in tough and emerging markets like South Africa. The book has real-world case studies, over 50 online tools, and he tackles the science, the art, and the mindset required to truly scale. So he joins me on the program now. Jason, a very warm welcome, and I want to jump straight in to Law 4, which you call the Law of Simplicity. And you say that to succeed on your epic quest, you need a vessel that can weather the currents, navigate the storms, and outmaneuver the competition. You go on to say your company's capacity to manage complexity must exceed the complexity coming at you. What type of complexity are we talking here, and how do you navigate through it?
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to join you. So one could summarize by saying it gets harder and harder to make decisions and to align your people to be working together towards the most important goals. And that's because, you know, there are more and more people, and there are more and more processes, and there are more and more decisions to be made, and it gets very difficult to align. And so what you need is you need flow in your organization. You need streamlined processes. You need structures that work so that everybody is able to work together towards the most important goals in the business.
With, I imagine, the caveat that given the complexity is organic and it's changing all the time, you need to be very adept at pivoting.
It's becoming one of the challenges of our time is balancing, on the one hand, scaling against a scalable business model that's proven and repeatable, and on the other hand, being adaptive. And that is becoming one of the defining leadership attributes of successful scale-up leaders today.
So you talk about that spot between 10 and 200, and often they're in a degree of survival mode. How then do you convince founders to stop and think about strategy, which is critical, when they are, I imagine, putting out fires and dealing with the vagaries of complexity every day?
It's a huge challenge, and normally, being blunt, pain is the best teacher. You know, when it's been long enough that things just aren't working, normally, you know, founders and leaders start realizing we need to do things differently. What got us here won't get us there. We've been trapped in busyness, and okay, we need to rethink how we're doing. So pain, the pain that things are not working, is normally the best tool.
You also talk, and this is Law 5 now, the law of capacity, and the secret to upgrade any organization's scalability is by building organizational capacity for scale. I'm interested to know, Jason, what organizational capacity is and how you go around developing that. I'm assuming that it's a lot more than just finding the right people.
Absolutely, although that is key. You know, when you're small, really the system by which you run the business is you. It's the top leaders. You are the system. All decisions go through you. You're on top of everything. You're involved in everything. And there comes a point where that breaks. There's just too much going on. And then what you need is to build capacity to run the business well. And that capacity is the management systems, processes, and structures that run the business well at scale. And so, of course, one key part of that is a management team with the capabilities and experience required to manage a business at scale. But of course, those people then in turn, they build teams, processes and systems which they lead, which run the business smoothly as it grows.
Jason, you begin one of your chapters with, I think, a fairly well-known quote by the boxer Mike Tyson. He says, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And given the South African dynamic that many businesses work in, they're getting punched in the mouth every day. They are hustling all the time. How do you find a balance between strategy on the one side and the hustle on the other? Because often success of entrepreneurs is defined by their ability to hustle, if I've got this right.
That's right. And particularly for very small businesses, say under 20 headcount, it's you know, defined almost only by the ability to hustle well. But if you're going to scale, that on its own is not enough. You need to then balance both hustle and, on the other hand, scaling against a scalable business model and set of structures. And so the prime disciplines that we recommend to get the balance right all are encompassed in a leadership operating system. It's a set of habits that almost create the scaffolding for how you run the company, a set of leadership habits, which then brings into balance the hustle, which, you know, obviously you need to continue and in fact get better and better at, but then harness within a structured approach to running the company. And that operating system is habits like having an annual plan, quarterly priorities, which are aligned amongst team members, you know, weekly alignment check-ins to make sure we're working on the top priority goals. These kinds of sound management habits counterbalance the hustle so that you get those two things in the right balance.
I like the analogy of the scaffolding. And Jason, somewhere on that scaffolding is sitting what you term a purple cow, something that is truly remarkable. Explain to me how you go about identifying the purple cow and why it's important.
Sure. So the analogy, or rather the metaphor, comes from Seth Godin in the book by the same title, Purple Cow. He explains how when a business grows, competition increases and suddenly you become commoditized. You're just the same as everybody else. You can imagine somebody standing on top of a hill looking down at a field full of black and white cows. And, you know, there are big cows, small cows, sick cows, healthy cows, but all they see is black and white cows. You don't want to just be a black and white cow in a market full of black and white cows. You want to be the only purple cow in that field when somebody's looking down from the hill and they're looking for a purple cow. And you're the only one. That's what you need to be. And so you need to build your business around a remarkable promise that a subset of the market, a niche, is looking for, and nobody does, but you do it, and you do it well. And that makes you remarkable. It makes you stand out from the crowd like a purple cow, and you can really scale a business around being a purple cow, because you can defend your margins, you can defend your cash flow, and even as the company scales, you know, you've got the wind in your sails rather than just being drowned by competition.
Jason, with your permission, I'm going to mix my agricultural metaphors now. I absolutely understand restructuring an operation or building an operation around a single purple cow or purple promise. But isn't there a degree of risk there, putting all your eggs in one basket?
Yes, I like the way you mix your agricultural metaphors there. There is, of course, and there are, scaling a business is managing a number of tensions. And this is one of those, which is everything I just said is true. And it's true at the same time as you needing to be future-proof. And so one of the leadership disciplines in the domain of strategy is to manage in three time horizons. In your current time horizon, you are making sure that you are the purple cow. But in your 3 to 5 year time horizon, you're taking a view on how the market's going to unfold and develop based on changes in technology and regulation and competitive forces and so forth. And you are already thinking about and proactively planning how you will position yourself in that future marketplace. And you are doing the work today, but typically with something like 20% of your capital and your talent to prepare for that future. So you are both focused on being a purple cow today and also preparing for the future that is coming, and you're preparing to be positioned to be a purple cow in future as well.
And there's a lot more in it. The book is called The Art of Scale, Mastering the Craft of Growth by Jason Goldberg. Jason is known as the Scale Up Guy, and with his co-founders launched Edge Growth. The book is published by Tracy McDonald Publishers. Jason, thank you very much indeed. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're back tomorrow, live at noon, and then as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.